Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Craig, and I'm an alcoholic. Privileged to be here, and of course, really, the people that have worked on the committee and have worked on this convention, your privilege is much greater than mine because you really have taken the time, gone the extra length to make something like this happen. And right now, I just really hope you're feeling like I think you are, and you really have worked wonders. Can you imagine the energy in this room? And just imagine that hotel manager was up here a little while ago, and he was really appreciative of us. Can you imagine that kind of energy before we came into AA? And in each one of our rooms, we have this refrigerator, and in this refrigerator, in every one of our rooms, is vodka, gin, Scotch, Seagram's, Daniel's, rum, vodka, Regal, cream, da da da. Candy and sugar. Can you imagine what this place would be like right now before we came into Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, the people actually gave us the key to that thing, you know? Yes, we have come a long way. I am an alcoholic and I have a disease. And that was described to me, and as I accept it today, is fourfold. It's a physical disease in that I have to drink alcohol in order to have an allergic reaction to it. And when I have an allergic reaction to alcohol, that is something that happens and I cannot control it. It's an allergy. With all my faculties, my brain, everything I can muster up inside myself, I can't do anything about it. I have an allergy. And I accept that today. That's easy for me to accept today. Alcoholism is a mental disease. In that I have a great desire and always have had a great desire to do something important, to be significant. As an ego, it's a gift from God. It's part of being a human being. But at the same time, in having this great desire to be of some worth in the world, I got another side of me that says, you aren't worth anything. You don't have what it takes to be the President of the United States. You don't really have what it takes to hold a job down. You really have what it takes to be cool. And that's a conflict. You know, I think an easier way to describe a conflict is I'm right here and life is right here, and this is alcoholism, and I used to go like this. That's a conflict, you know? And I wanted to get from here to here, but I kept doing this. And that's the mental part of this disease that I have. I have an emotional disease in that the day I took a drink, I lost every chance I had of maturing, of actually trying to get in control of my emotions and have an opportunity to live life to its fullest. I lost that ability to grow in that area the day I took a drink when I was 13 years old. It's gone. And it's a spiritual disease that I have in that I was destined in my approach to life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to wrap myself up in me, in the smallest package possible, isolating myself from the warmth of the world or the people in it or God as He works through those people. I, like all of you out there, knew desolation. My sponsor showed me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous 9 paragraphs in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started with me in the back of the book, under the spiritual appendix. And he showed me the indispensables to the recovery of alcoholism. Honesty, got to be honest with myself. I've got to be willing to do something. I've got to be willing to change. And I've got to be open-minded. Yeah, but. No yeah, buts. As soon as yeah, buts there, the mind's closed. Nothing's going to come in that day. He took me showed me, didn't show me, my sponsor made me read aloud to him, standing in front of him, these 9 paragraphs. My sponsor assumed nothing. And he showed me, asked me to read on page 27 somewhere, 3 more paragraphs. And these 3 paragraphs basically had to do with Dr. Young talking to Roland. Really, actually, in all humility, telling this helpless drunk that as one of the leading psychoanalysts in the world, he was totally baffled by this disease that he had. And he was saying, sorry, Roland, you know, you're ready to check out of this hotel. But basically, the attitudes, ideas, and emotions that are the guiding forces in your life that are killing you have got to be abandoned, and you've got to adopt a whole new set of motives. And then my sponsor had me read aloud to him on page 45 in that big book just exactly what the dilemma is with the disease of alcoholism. And it's not alcohol. Alcohol is a symptom of the disease of alcoholism. It is the lack of power. That is the dilemma with the disease of alcoholism. Another one of these. Now, I have, in this roundabout sort of way, kind of memorized that. And, you know, anybody new can memorize that pretty quickly. And that's head knowledge is kind of what that is. And what I'd like to try to describe for you in the next few minutes is how it went from here, that journey of 12 inches down into my heart. And it didn't happen as quickly as I just said it to you. I remember one year it snowed a great deal in Akron, Ohio, where I was growing up. And I earned a lot of money. I earned more money than I ever had in my entire life in one day, in a few short hours. Now, I did not take that money, rush home, show my father and my mother, run upstairs, and pack it into my piggy bank for when I was going to be a Boy Scout or a Cub Scout or go to college. I did what I consider the equivalent of a drunk, of a little big shot, and I busted into the bar, which was basically was the soda fountain in my neighborhood. I mean, I flew straight into the soda fountain. Hey, everybody, ice cream on me. You know, hi, Julie here, buy a sundae. Hey, Mac, here's a chocolate Coke for you, man. Hey, here's 50 cents, put some weight on. You know, one of those kind of guys. And I did that. I was 4 years old. And I was a little big shot. I had all this more money than I ever had in my life, and I just blew it all in one day. Candy and sugar and this and that. And I bought models that I couldn't even build that were beyond my ability to build. I was buying models for 16-year-olds, and I was 4. And then when I couldn't put the models together, I felt that inferiority. I had a desire to be great. I had a desire to try to do something important, and I blew it. I couldn't build this model that I bought, and I wanted to. And I was embarrassed in front of my father and my brothers and everything. And at 4 and 5, I felt this. I felt inferior. At 13 years of age, I had my first drink, and it turned into my first drunk. And I don't remember much about it. I'll tell you the part I remember. I backed out of my sleeping bag. I had my tennis shoes on, and that was all. My pants were in a tree, smoking, smoldering. A quick little inventory of my body produced the fact that I had every excretion known to man on me. Pick an excretion, any excretion, it was there. And that was my first encounter with alcohol. And all I remember from that whole experience was they said, God, were you funny? And that's all I held on to. I didn't hold on to that sickness and the fact that I was naked, I had my tennis shoes on, and that's all I remember was, boy, you were important, you were significant, you contributed greatly to our enjoyment that night. And that type of drinking just continued on ad infinitum. When I had an opportunity as I was, I don't know, stumbling through college, I don't know how that happened, but what did I do when I was in college? I drank. What did I do when I had a chance to study in London? I drank. What did I do when I had a chance to study in Stockholm? I drank. What did I do when I got to Italy? Drank. What did I do when I went to South America?
Drank.
A little cocaine too, guys. Drank. What did I do when I was in Canada?
Drank.
And we're noticing a pattern here, right? And that's what's important. I developed a pattern. In order to live, I had to drink. And it was that simple. And I had to drink first in order to live. It had to be there. I got sick, and I just continued to get sicker. And then March 6, 1978, I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I fell down on my knees in total desolation and confusion and frustration at a wit's end, drinking all day from 6 in the morning as usual till 11 o'clock that night and not being able to get drunk. Not getting any release or any sense of satisfaction from it. And I said the three magic words. God help me. And I meant it. And He has. I went to a detox unit long before it was fashionable. It had bars on the windows. It wasn't on the third floor in this sanitarium. It was in the basement. Light bulbs hanging. I didn't like it. I wasn't real excited about this new journey I was on. And I didn't come out of my room for 3 days. But the thing that's important is that I didn't identify with anybody in there. I just tolerated it because I was so afraid to do anything else. I was staying dry out of fear. And that's a horrible existence, but that's the best I could do. Two people came down to talk to me to be a sponsor. And first guy that came down talked about how he chased his wife around the bed with a butcher knife. And the second guy that came down talked about being a professor in law. Now, which one do you think I chose? For some reason, I chose the guy with a law degree because I figured he was safer. And if I was going to join this really what I considered a derelict society, I was going to have a professor of law as my sponsor. For moi. It's very haughty. And, you know, the funny thing was, he was a brilliant man. He was a great man and a very sober man, but I never called him. He never called me. And as a result, I just kind of hung around Alcoholics Anonymous for about 18 months. And for some reason, I don't know, I kind of backed into a little service work, and I was moderating a panel called Gratitude Sunday in Akron. And the day before, I stopped in to see my sponsor because he was in the hospital. I figured, God, you know, guy's going to have bypass surgery tomorrow. I think I might go see him. Really, we're sick, sick, pompous, haughty, scared, really, just scared. And Hollis said something to me that he never said to me before, and he basically said, you better get busy. And he never pushed AA at me, never, never. But he said, you better get busy. And he was supposed to go into an operation at 3 o'clock the next day. I remember he said that. And I was working at this panel, moderating a panel, and I had to look at a clock and watch so that I could time the speaker. And right at 5 till 3, I suddenly remembered my sponsor, and I said a prayer for him. And later on that night, I called his wife to see how he was doing, and my sponsor died at 3 o'clock, right when I was looking at my watch, thinking about it. And something hit me, something just like the hush that came over the room. Something hit me like a ton of bricks, like, I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous for about 18 months now. I never knew this man. He's dead. He's gone. As much as a day ago, I could have given a damn whether he was alive or not. And now he's gone. And it did something to me. It was like, this just all isn't going to be here for me whenever I think I'm ready to come and get it. And I asked Flo if there was anything I could do to help. I never, ever asked if there's anything I could do to help. I asked his wife, is there anything I can do to help? She said, just come over and just be here. And so I did. And as a result, I ended up I just helped her bury him. And I can remember going through checkbook and balancing it and taking his clothes out of the closet and I just got absorbed into trying to relieve the grief of his children and his wife. And buried him. But he died sober and he died a winner and he died 14 or 15 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I was kind of hoeing and hemming and hawing around Alcoholics Anonymous at that point, I was at what was my home group, Men's Tuesday Night Hilltop. Greatest meeting in the universe, it was. Greatest meeting, and there were people from all over the universe there. I can vouch for that. And I'll never forget the night I saw this one particular individual from across the room. I looked at him. Had his coat strapped over his left arm and just tie was undone. I mean, he looked like life had just, like Magic Johnson had just slam dunked this guy. You know what I mean? Just, whew. My little mind kicked on and said, new guy. boom, I run across the room, stick my hand out. Hi, my name is Craig Schreiner. You keep coming to these meetings, these people are going to help you. This guy looked at me, kind of went like that, and just smiled. He said, thank you. And I said, yeah, thank you. And I just went on my self-centered way, and I was, you know, like a little tornado, just doing whatever I needed to do in alcohol. And people would come up and say, hey, Craig, how you doing? I'd go, great, fantastic, wonderful. And I was lying. I was miserable. I hated you. I didn't want to be in this fellowship. I didn't want to have anything to do with you people. About 20 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was living the big book. I was living that part in Bill Wilson's story about golf. I would go to one meeting a week, and I would play golf at least 6 times a week. Because I read in Bill's story when he was playing golf and writing fat checks at the country club, but that was in his qualification for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't see that part. So I was doing my normal thing. I was playing golf alone and cheating. Playing golf alone and cheating. Cheating, seriously. Oh, I didn't see that shot. We won't count that, will we? No, we won't count that. Oh, sick. And I was on a par 5 hole, and in front of me, on the green, was a threesome. And I said to myself, you know, they're awfully far away. There's no way if I hit this shot, I can hit the green, because it's too far. So I started to take, subconsciously, an inventory of this golf shot that I was going to make. An inventory of all. And I said to myself, you know, I'm really going to take an easy does it attitude about this golf shot because really I don't want to hit it too hard because what if I did hit it and it hit those people on the green? So I'm going to lay up, take it really easy. So I just relaxed and which was not normal for me. And, matter of fact, I had exercised a degree of humility in the selection of the golf club I was going to use. I used a club that even if you hit it well wouldn't get there. So I was just, you know, thinking through it and I just wound up and just, and I just went like that and went, dink. The ball took off. I look at the club real fast and what did I just hit? And looking at the ball, whee! Wow! All of a sudden I realized, oh my God, it's going to hit the green where those people are. Four! And I saw this guy go, whoa! This ball goes flying right by him. And I'm going, oh my God, I almost hit that guy. Well, what I just described for you is the most arrogant, pompous, self-centered thing you can do on a golf, impolite, incourteous thing you can do on a golf course. That's breaking almost all of golf etiquette. And you can hurt somebody with a golf ball. 20 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. And as I'm dragging my bag, only growing through repeated humiliations, and I'm going up to this green to apologize to these people, I notice that a guy I almost hit is this new guy I saw at the meeting about a couple of months ago. And I'm thinking to myself, I am an example of the big book, you know. So just as I was ready to, in all humiliation, with no humility, but to apologize for what I did, this guy goes, nice shot. And of course I forgot all about the apology. Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. I said, will you want to play with us? And I said, sure. So I finished the round with me. He invited me to play the rest of the round with his threesome. So my brain kicked into gear now for that. I think it was the second time this month. And I said, new guy, right? Heard I take him to a meeting. I said, hey, you want to go to a meeting? Yeah. So get him in the car and we start driving. And I started thinking about what they told me at these meetings. I said, okay, you know, we're going to a meeting. This is an open meeting. You know, we got different kinds of meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous and missing cars and things like that. And, you know, we've got closed discussion meetings, and I'm just parroting all I knew about it. Read the book, don't drink, read the book. And I thought I was just being a parrot. That's all I knew, you know. So I took her to this meeting, and we sat down, went through it, and it was a good meeting. And then after the meeting, my brain kicked into gear again and said, fellowship. I heard that fellowship. Hey, would you like to go get a restaurant, or go to a restaurant and get something to eat? And he said, yeah. So I'm driving along, and I'm saying, okay, now we got literature in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got an intergroup in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm thinking to myself as I'm saying this, I don't even know where intergroup is, you know? and we got, you know, we do these things, and we get to the restaurant, order, and I'm telling about it, and the waitress finally brings us our food. I take a bite out of my hamburger, and I'm chewing. Now, this represents the first time since this person has met me that he can actually say something. And he asked me about something on page, I forget, in the big book. And as I'm chewing my cud, I started to think, I never even heard of that. And I just kind of just blew it off or something, you know. He says, well, have you ever read this thing in the 12 and 12? And I'm thinking to myself, what is the 12 and 12? I'm thinking. My brain kicked into gear for the third time this month. Second time in about an hour. And I said, maybe this guy's not new. And so I asked him, I said, hey, wait a second. How long have you been in AA? He brushed it off. He changed the subject instantly. He said, a reasonable length of time. It's not important. Yeah, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God. You know? No, I said, wait a second. How long have you been in AA? I said it about that loud in a restaurant, and I blew this guy's anonymity, and everybody's looking at us now, and I'm, you know, this poor guy, you know. He goes, I don't know, 16, maybe 17 years. This new guy that I was going to sponsor today is my sponsor. It was only through repeated humiliations that I learned anything about humility. 20 months around Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what it had produced. Well, as a result, having lost a sponsor and not used him, I did have a different attitude about this individual, and I asked him to be a sponsor, and we started to work together. And as a result of starting to embark upon the steps, we came upon a very thorough and moral inventory of myself, and I remember talking about the main items in that inventory. I don't want to bore you with any of this, but there are some things that I had to look at in my life. I had to do it in paper. I had to do it with the guidance of an individual who has been there, who's done it themselves and demonstrated it themselves. And as a result, I can remember touching upon the main things, and one of them was fear. Fear. My sponsor would ask me, did you like to wear an app crank? Now, my sponsor, you know, I talk funny about him, but he's a Cajun. You know, he's a little guy. He looks like Yoda. He's, you know, just... And he talks funny. But did you like to wear an app crank? He's a fanatic about looking words up. And I looked up the word. And basically, fear was living in the future. And he would say, why do you want to live in the future, Craig? He would just ask simple questions. And I didn't know why I wanted to live in the future. Well, basically, because I had a lack of faith in my life. The future scared me because I had no faith that things were going to be okay. And that's what he showed me. And as a result of listening, I don't know how many different fears I had. But I listed them, and I went through them, and I read them, and they just dropped. They dissolved from me. I still have to deal with fears today, but now knowing what they are, I can arrest it a little better, getting a little more masterful at handling them. And then when I wasn't fearing the future, I was resenting the past, you know? So resentments was a big item in this inventory, and when I wasn't in the future, guess where I was? In the past. Why do you want to live in the past, Craig? And he would ask those simple questions. And I don't know why I want to live in the past, you know. I listed all my resentments, and I had resentments against myself and God and parents and any authority, and Sister Mary resentment from Catholic school and everything else. And I just realized that's what I was doing in the simplest form. That's what I was doing. I was living in the past. And then when I wasn't fearing the future and resenting the past, I was experiencing guilt about sex in the present. I shouldn't have that thought. Yeah. And after I got done with my inventory and that part about sex, that's basically all I did have was a lot of thoughts. You know, as a matter of fact, my sponsor said, that was boring, you know. And then he told me about his sex life, and God, was he right. Mine was boring compared to his. I didn't know you could do those kinds of things. Really, what happened at that point was that I realized that I wasn't alone. All these things and these skeletons I had in the closet, all these things I was hiding, I wasn't alone. He had done everything and then some, and if I haven't done it, you probably have. That's right, you. A girl took his arm off of him that was saying... As a result of working through the steps, I began to get a little... sense of freedom in alcoholics. I began to recover a little bit. Began to be able to focus in the present. But did I want to put chairs away and empty ashtrays. And no, man, we're going golfing now, you know. What do you mean sponsor somebody? You know what? That's people are DCMs or something like that, you know. So I played golf. And I went on different dry drunks, we call them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, we all have had that first dry drunk, the self-pity, I don't want to be an alcoholic dry drunk, you know. Just low hole, I don't want to be an alcoholic, you know. Got anything but being an alcoholic, you know. And I had that self-pity, it lasted, I don't know, 18, 19 months. And then after I had a chance to work on the steps with the guidance of the sponsor, the next dry drunk was the happy dry drunk. Hey, I'm sober now, guys. Look out, girls. We're coming Sobriety Express, you know. Sick. Real sick. And so I was on this happy dry drunk. Let's do whatever Craig wants to do anytime Craig wants to do it. You know, he's actually alive for the first time in his life, and now we're going to have some fun. And so I used to do a lot of things except really what I was supposed to do. As a result, fell off a lot of white horses and it hurt. But the beautiful thing about it was my sponsor wears these big padded soft gloves. And he was always there to catch me when I was ready to smash on the ground. And he would help me and he would soothe me and he would chew my butt and he loved me. He loved me with a lot of hard love at times when I needed it. And of course, the most dangerous of all was the spiritual dry drunk. Really, you know, this is scary. I know how to stay sober. What do you mean you don't want to work the four-step that way? Go start a meeting or get out of here or, you know, you can't come to our group if you don't want to do it that way. And that's scary. I really experienced a lot of isolation. I actually started to think that I knew what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some stupid reason, if you didn't stay sober the way I thought or did what I thought you should do in meeting, I would get resentments or I would try to change your life or I would... And I don't know, a little bit of knowledge is horrible for me. It's, that person who constantly wants to be great or a desire to do great things, and I experience a little success, and you're going to do it the same way I did, or you're going to die, you know? I don't know how many meetings I ruined by not being there. Physically, I was there, but mentally, I was killing the guy at the podium. I was strangling him. He wasn't doing anything right. That's a miserable way to live, but I'll never forget how I came off this. I called my sponsor. Oh my God, I got this letter, and it was a couple years back. I got a letter from New York. The 25th Icky Paw was there, international, in New York City. And I was asked to participate on a panel, and I was just ecstatic. Imagine that. Little super Mr. AA asked to go and talk about, I don't know, whatever it was. And I didn't even bother reading that. I called my sponsor, George, you can't believe this. I get to go to international. I get to talk at someone's thing. And he interrupted me. The little guy interrupted me. He said, did you look up those words I gave you? I was really kicked at him. I'm saying, how did... And I said, what words? He said, pompous. Haughty. Arrogant. And he popped my bubble, you know? And I mean, I was just thinking, wow. He says, well, what's your talk? I said, well, I've been asked to go to New York and talk. Well, what's your subject? And I didn't even realize, I didn't even read that far. You know, I was on this ego trip and I read, I'm looking down. Humility. Phone drops. I hear this laughter in the background. And then how you're laughing so hard and you can't stop, and he gets the phone, and he gets his composure, and he's trying to go, and he goes, what are you gonna say, Craig? Talk about being in the right place at the wrong time. And so it was only through repeated humiliations that I learned anything about humility. As a result of experiencing a number of different growing problems or situations, sober and trying to struggle in Alcoholics Anonymous, something did happen as I fell off these dry drunks and worked through problems. I started to take the time to work with other people. Something started to happen, and actually people began to be attracted to me. People in Alcoholics Anonymous, something that I'd always wanted but never knew how to do. And as a result of starting to do what my sponsor asked me to do, and starting to empty ashtrays, getting a meeting as a GS, or as a secretary to a meeting, getting there early, making coffee, beginning to accept these responsibilities, next thing I knew, people started to come up to me and ask me questions. And people started to say, well, hey, you know, will you sponsor me if you? And I started to work with different people. And at that point in time, that little teeny package that I was talking about, I was wrapping myself in my up in myself and isolating myself from the warmth and the light of the world and all of the great things that life has to offer, the wrapper started to fall off. And there was this little gleam and this little, just little beam of light in the very inside, and it started to shine. And as a result, I got an opportunity to work with different people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it really was the most single important contributing factor to what I call peace of mind and self-worth today. And I'll never forget, and I hope I don't ever, about this one particular individual. I called him the 1230 kid. And this guy was unbelievable. I was sober, I don't know, 3 or 4 years at the time. Just starting to really get involved and get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy would come into meetings. His name was Gary. And Gary, I don't know, every time he got into a meeting, I'd look outside for a spaceship or something like that. But he would physically intimidate people. Get out of my way, I want to sit there. Or he'd go up to some girl in the middle of the meeting, I'm going to hit on you, he'd say. You know? The guy would, he was honest, you know. Had orange hair. Lots of it. Chains. Now we're talking about 10 years ago, folks. This dog on the roof group, you guys look like ballerinas compared to this guy. And he was the only one. There wasn't 60 of them. There was just one. And this guy asked me, will you sponsor me? And my God, I said, yes. I just fired my other sponsor, and I didn't like the way you did it, man. And his other sponsor just came up to me after the meeting and said, I understand, Gary wants you to sponsor him. He was twitchy. He said, there's one way to sponsor Gary, and that's with a baseball bat. And he was, he's ready to explode. This guy was sweating, and I backed off a little bit from him, you know. Started to realize, what have I just done, you know? Well, Gary and I went out to eat that night, and had dinner. We went over to my apartment, and I talked about how I was going to sponsor him because I was sponsored a certain way, and that's the only way I know how to give it away. So we were going over the itinerary, let's call it. We got to the inventory.
I ain't going to do no inventory.
I said, well, yeah, you are. I've done it. All the other people I work with done it, and that's the only way we know how to stay sober. You got to write.
I ain't going to write no. I can't write.
I said, what do you mean you can't write? I can't read. I said, what do you mean you can't read? I just took you to a restaurant, and you ordered off the menu. I said, I guessed. And he couldn't read. He only had third grade, fourth grade reading level. So I said, well, we'll get to that problem. He said, I'll get a woman to write it for me. I'm going, God, we got things to work on, you know? And God bless him, he came over one night. We started to work on the inventory. We do it one night a week. Well, he came over and we started to write. And he started to write, and he said, I can't spell these words. I said, well, just let me know and I'll help you. Well, you know, he gets the cat. I said, C-A-T, you know, and we're writing along a little bit more. And about 20 minutes later, he says, dog. Dog, I'm thinking to myself, God, I can't wait to hear this fifth step. I'm going, man, oh, man, it's going to be real interesting. You know, when are we going to get to something human, you know? I mean, it's just like, God, I'm this guy's sponsor, you know. Well, at any rate, he ended up writing his inventory, and he wouldn't even stay on the lines. As he would write a sentence, it would kind of curl off. And well, after a couple of weeks of this, he felt good about the fact that he had written this. And the reason I call him a 1230 kid is because just about every night he would call me at about 1230 or 1 in the morning. You know, phone ring. I'm sleeping. I pick up the phone. Hi, Gary. Oh, hi, Gary. How you doing? I don't know, man. Somebody's shooting at me. You know what I'm going to say? Shooting at you? Yeah, yeah, he was mentioning something about some guy's wife or something, you know, and I'm going, oh, my God. And I didn't chew him out or anything. I just sat there and listened, and I said, okay, now, Gary, what have we learned about other guys' wives, you know, things like that, you know. And he would work himself through the problem. I didn't do anything. Before I hung up, I'd say, call me tomorrow night, Gary, about 8 o'clock, would you? And I'd hang up. Next night, 1:30 in the morning, a phone would be ringing. Hey, the motorcycle gang beating at my door, you know. God, what do you do? He says, I don't know. He mentioned something about some guy's Harley Davidson he borrowed, or I don't know what it was. Okay, Gary, what have we learned about borrowing other people's Harley Davidsons, you know, without asking them, you know? And I realized he got real mad at me about third month of working together. And he really did. He screamed at me one night. He says, why don't you yell at me? You don't ever yell at me. So you don't care. You don't give a damn about me. He says, you never yell at me. You don't care about it. And I started to realize that I was really, as best I could, I was just demonstrating, for the first time in my life, unconsciously, unconditional love of a human being that I wouldn't even have sat next to in a meeting 6 months prior to that. And I'd realized that all I was doing was just totally accepting this human being on his terms and just trying to provide a vehicle through which something bigger and greater than myself can work. That's God. And as a result, I started to cry a little bit, and I said, Gary, I love you. I love you a lot. I don't know why I don't yell at you or scream at you. I guess I just don't think it'll work. Everybody else has tried to sponsor you with baseball bats. I don't know. I began to realize that I started to grow in a bond with this person. Now, what would you do with a guy like that when you had a conference, a young people's convention? We put him in charge of welcoming. And I'll never forget at that Saturday night meeting. Larry, you were there. And this guy came in, hair was cut. Totally shaved, brand new suit on, looked like $1 million. As a matter of fact, the girls were saying, who's this guy? It was like who's this guy? You know, who's Gary? And Gary stood in front of 750 people that night and read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never forget when he got to the word controversy, and he mispronounced it. He was standing up there struggling. Sandy B is sitting right there, you know, a guy who's spoken international in New Orleans in front of 35,000 people. You know, this guy's, he's reading the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. He got to the word controversy and he couldn't pronounce it. As a matter of fact, he got stuck on it. But nobody said anything. And then I could see him starting to sweat. He blew it off and he read the rest of the preamble. And he got to the end of the preamble and he remembered the word and he said, controversy! And 750,000 people just flew out of their seats and just applauded thunderously for this guy. And I just saw it, Sandy Beach just blew him away. Absolutely blew him away by the intensity of the meeting. And I just started to see this ugly duckling turn into a beautiful swan right in front of my eyes. And I had nothing to do with it. All I did was just listen and love. That's all I did. I did what you taught me, and I did what they try to get in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous is to become a vehicle through which this power greater than ourselves can work. Be able to transmit that electricity with the spirit of the fellowship. And that's all. All I would do is to be willing to do that. But things started to happen to me inside as a result of that kind of living. As a result, success started to enter into my life. Success started to enter into my life in all areas of my life. Just not Alcoholics Anonymous. We got involved with conventions, and we dedicated ourselves like these great people have done through the course of a year and did what we had to do to put on a convention, and we started new meetings and young people's meetings, and we would travel around to Ikepa, wherever it was, and we got the International in Cincinnati 1 year, and we all played our part, and I just went crazy on Alcoholics Anonymous for I don't know how long. But Alcoholics Anonymous wants us to do a little more than just in AA. Alcoholics Anonymous wants us to become a full, balanced citizen. And get back into the community as well. And it wants us to have a job. Alcoholics, believe it or not, guys, I'm sorry, or girls, you know, AA does want us to go back to work, too, you know, and earn a living and things like that. And stop living off of other people and, you know, that easier, softer way. And I went back to school. Jeff, I went back to school. And I'll never forget, I was 5 or 6 years sober when I went back to school because I started to pursue a dream, a sober dream about what I wanted to do with my life. My sponsor had me do an inventory at about 5 years of what I wanted to do in my life. The inventory of all the skeletons and the hate and the resentment and the fears and all, that was done. The 10th step kind of helps me, you know, stay current with the problems and the resentments and the envy and things of those sort. But he wanted me to do an inventory of what do you want out of life now? You have a chance now. You can actually live in the present. What do you want to do with it? And so I wrote down. I started to pursue this dream. I went back to school. I'll never forget the first day in math class. Worst subject for me ever was math, right? Through the first two, oh God, look at the faces, I love it. You're gonna identify with it. We took a little inventory, a test that they take, you know, to kind of find out where your head is, and they give you everything from adding 2 + 2 to calculus. And there were 20 questions. And I did the best I could. The next day they handed it out. I got the worst grade in the class. I got 3 right out of, but I was 32 years old at the time, and I was back in college, and there's 18, 19 year old kids, and so on, and when the teacher said, "Does anybody have any problems? Would you any questions about? Want to go over some stuff about the test?" And you know, something weird was happening this time. I was in the front row in math. I don't know what I was. I was in the front row. I wasn't in the back hiding. My hand went up. "Yeah, could you answer number two?" And she went through number two. And then I said, "Three, four, five, seven, eight, nine, ten." And a lot of people in the class were getting a little ticked off. Like, "God, what is this guy's problem?" I didn't care what they thought at that point in time. I had every right to know everything about the stuff I didn't know. And I said, 14, 15, 16, 17. And the next, you know, she said, "You can get a tutor." I'm thinking to myself, a tutor? Oh, you mean a math sponsor? You know, I can get a math sponsor. And I got a math sponsor. And I started to do the homework every night. I stayed current. I accepted the responsibility of the class, and I stayed current when I did my homework every night. You know, miracles happen when you do your homework every night. And then I took the next test, and I got a C on the first test. And then I got a B on the next test. And then I got an A on the last test. And every quiz I took got better and better and better. And you know what happens when you do all your homework? You show up to class every day. You take all... I mean, they actually give you extra points for doing all your homework. I never knew that. I mean, I never did all my homework ever in my life. And then if you do this well and you show up, they let you drop the worst test. And the next thing I know, I'm thinking, "God, look at this. This is a math class." And you know, when we took that final exam of 175 questions, I got 173 right. I got the highest grade in the class. I always wanted to do and had a great desire to do something and be somebody. And it happened. And then I did the same thing. "Hey, well, that's math. And those are those simple principles of, you know, maybe being honest and open-minded and willing to change." And I said, "I wonder if this stuff will apply to chemistry." Hey, it does apply to, and I got a chemistry sponsor. And I worked, and I got great grades in chemistry. And the next thing I know, and you know what? I started to realize something phenomenal. You can actually become friends with somebody who helps you. Imagine that, being friends with somebody who helps you. That was a novel idea to me. So I liked my math sponsor, and I actually liked the person. And something strange started to happen to me as a result of growing in the success of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was approaching life a little differently now. That was one of the small successes. I was voted as class president. I was given an opportunity because when I went through the lunch line every day, I would see these ladies that were serving the food. And a lot of the kids, when you're 18, 19, you know, you take for granted that everything in the world is there. And when I would go through the line, I would have a joke for the day for the women that worked behind the counter. Horrible jokes, but I would have a joke for the day. And every time I walked in there, before I would even have my joke for the day, their faces would light up and they'd smile because they'd say, "Here comes that guy again. The guy that always tells those horrible jokes." I would think to myself as I rounded the corner to walk into the cafeteria, I know their faces are going to light up. And when I walked in, their faces lit up. Well, the lady who was the head cook noticed this through the course of the year. And she said, "I understand that you're looking for a place to rent next year." And I'm thinking to myself, "Yeah, that's right. I have to live down here." And I was back in school. I was living on peanuts. I was literally trying to do the best I could. And as a result, she said, "Well, come over to my house, and I'll let you see the place. And if you want to rent it next year, you can." I said, "Great." So I went over there and looked at the place. And my God, it's on a 1,700-acre farm. I get the whole top floor. I'm thinking to myself, it's all been renovated. Got orchards and dogs and trees and sheep. And I'm thinking, good God, people. How many people in here have done their four steps? You know? And I'm thinking, I can't afford something like this. This is going to be too much. And I asked her, I said, "Well, how much do you want, you know, to rent this place?" She looked at me and she said, "Oh, if you live here, I won't charge you anything. And you'll get three meals a day, too." These kinds of things did not happen to me before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to live there free. As a result of having the grades that I did that year in school and president, I got two scholarships. My next year was free. Room and board, tuition. Always wanted to do great things or be important. Things started to change in my life. I'll never forget a graduation day, front row. My father and my stepmother were sitting there. Graduation day, front row. As president of Senate, president of the student body, I got to address the graduating class. The dean of the school gave a talk. Boring. Lieutenant governor gave a talk. Boring. I gave a talk. what was considered by the lieutenant governors the most profound talk on education he'd ever heard in his life, and I got a standing ovation. And you know what I talked about in this profound? I talked about the indispensables to learning: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. They said, "Wow, what a program." And I said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." Imagine that, standing there in front of a graduating class as a speaker and having something to contribute. And of course, you know where I got that. I got that in the appendix. Success in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two years ago, in January, almost 2 years to the date, I had a fabulous opportunity that I'll never have again in my entire life. I owe a great deal and a great debt to Sacramento, California. I'm here tonight for two reasons, basically. Number one, to be part of your convention, because I absolutely love you crazy people out here in California. And second to that, and just as important, my sobriety started here. My sponsor, that little Cajun from New Orleans, got sober in Sacramento, California 27 years ago. And Friday night, when I got here Friday afternoon, I didn't have a chance to come to the speaker meeting Friday night because I got a chance to meet the person who made the call on my sponsor 27 years ago. And I had dinner with him and his wife at his home up in North Sacramento. And I got to kind of complete a link in the chain. In January, 2 years ago, we did something as a result of a kind of the idea of pass it on. Kind of the idea, I'm going to take an analogy of the stairway to recovery or the step to recovery that we have here. And let's talk about, instead of stairs, let's just use people. Let's use sponsors. Or let's talk about that guy who made the step call on my sponsor. That was the first step in my sobriety. That's the first stepping stone that my sobriety is based on. It's anchored right here in Sacramento, California. And we kept hearing about my sponsor's sponsor. I mean, I never saw, like, I don't know. You always tell me whenever you have a problem, you go talk to your sponsor. I never knew he even had a sponsor. I never knew he existed. Well, we found out, and sure enough, he lived right here. He lives in Folsom. His name is Lee W. And my sponsor was having his 25th anniversary, and we were going to have a party, a big party. You know, my sponsor refuses to have recognition for years in sobriety. He just doesn't get off on that stuff. It's not important, because he realizes that it's really Alcoholics Anonymous that gets the tribute to staying sober that long. And he consented to doing this only if we would celebrate other people's birthdays as well, just not his, and that we would actually have a meeting. We wouldn't just have it, we would have our own kind of a special AA meeting. And so we did this. And I'll never forget, I was asked, and I was fortunate to be like the moderator at this fabulous meeting. And we called it The Beat Goes On. And we got to talking, and I said, "George, you know, every time we get in trouble and we got to do something, and we're in self-pity or we're on a dry drunk or everything, or we need help," you say, "Go on to your sponsor. Call your sponsor." I said, "We've never seen your sponsor. We don't even know that you have a sponsor. Has anybody out there seen his sponsor?" And everybody's going, "No, no, no, no." It was like a lynch mob. You know, George was getting a little, you know, scared. "No, no." And I said, "Well, how do we know you even have a sponsor?" And just at that moment, up in the back of the room, a guy goes, "I'm his sponsor." And we flew Lee out. And these two guys had not seen each other in 21 years. And they embraced in front of all of us in just tears, instant tears. And that's how we started his 25th anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the first generation. And then Lee talked about in the very beginning days when he and George had met. And Lee was drinking in the early days of my sponsor's sobriety. And my sponsor would chase him while he was still drinking and say, "What do you want me to do next?" And Lee would say, "Leave me alone, I want to drink, leave me alone." And George would go, "I didn't fire you yet, you're still my sponsor." And that's the kind of guy I got for a sponsor, you know. And he talked, and he was the first generation. And then my sponsor talked, and he was the second generation. And I got up to talk, and I was the third generation. And then one of my babies got up, and he talked about how he got it from his sponsor and how he turned around. And he gave it, and his little guy stood up. And that was the fifth generation. And then the sixth generation stood up. And then in front of us, we had seven generations of people living in sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. Walking up the steps, one based on the one, that link, that important link that's there. And to get to witness that and experience that type of thing and be part of it, that is success. There's nothing better and there's nothing more rewarding than that kind of unselfish work as far as Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings I can't describe for you other than they're just absolutely amazing. And how they've made me feel with what, as far as self-worth, as far as a human being is concerned. Success. May 21st, I met the co-founder of, well actually this organization hasn't started yet. I met what I consider to be the co-founder of the last fellowship that is going to use the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in their recovery. And I married her. Her name is Nina. And she is going to approach GSR, I'm sure, in New York, General Service Office, GSO, and she's going to come and she's going to say, can we use your recovery program to help us with our problem? And she's out there looking for that one other person to the other co-founder of this fellowship that they're, and the name of that fellowship will probably be Normal Anonymous. Well, there isn't anybody left, is there? You know, gambling, alcohol, flow, drugs, narcotics, etc., mental, da da da. Imagine this. 10 years sober, and I attracted, as a mate, for the rest of my life, a well-adjusted woman. Normal Anonymous, success. She gets a problem, she talks about it. She gets a resentment, she talks about it. She gets a grudge, she forgives you. Now, I don't know about any of you guys or any of you girls, but the people I hung out with before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous were not like that. And I'm fortunate today that I could actually attract such a human being and begin to embark now upon a journey that's bigger and bigger and bigger. Thing I'm talking about, I don't know what it is, the spirit of the fellowship. Dr. Young, that doctor that was talking to Roland, developed a term in his psychoanalytic days with Freud and whoever, and it was called synchronicity. And it's a word, I don't mean to boggle your mind or anything, but it means being in the right place at the right time. That's what that word means. It means you really are in the right, kind of like this guy right here that just bumped into us, and we absolutely destroyed your drinking, by the way, for the rest of your life. You, Jim, are in the right place at the wrong time. And then, of course, Harry, 33-some years, and he was in the right place at the right time tonight to be able to transmit one to the other. Synchronicity, being in the right place at the right time. Just for the heck of it, I thought on the flight out here, I would say, okay, I want to just maybe read something out of the 12 and 12, and I closed, and I was going to do one of those, and just open it, right? And I did it on the plane, and this is what I came up with. The AA answer to these questions about living is yes. All of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep trying to practice AA's 12 steps. And if these facts of life But these are facts of life for many alcoholics who have recovered in AA. They can become the facts of life for many more. And I just opened it right up to that, and I wanted to share that with you. I have a definition of what it means and what an alcoholic is today. And it's a little bit different than what it was when I was hiding in that room in that sanitarium 10 and a half years ago. As a result of having a sponsor who was emphatic about looking words up and making sure that you stand on firm ground with anything you think. I looked up the word alcohol one time in the dictionary, and it comes from a Latin word called spiritus. And it's a word, a really old word. And I looked spiritus up. And spiritus means the breath of life. That's what it means. That's that word boiled all the way down. Just all the way down to its essence. The breath of life. That's what alcohol means. Now where we got alcoholic, or that's where spiritus means. Where we got the word alcoholic was sometime in, early 1800s, late 1900s, when we started to study chemistry. We called that molecule, or that stuff inside of wine, or spirits, spiritus, that's how they got that word. We called it a natural organic compound. We call it an alcohol molecule. That's what it is. That's what the scientists call it. So therefore, they call that stuff the spirits in that wine that made all the knights of the round tables chase after the girls of the round tables, you know, and have resentments the next morning and a bad taste in their mouth and all that other stuff. What is that? The spiritus. It's the spirits in there. And then the chemists defined it and they called it alcohol. And then I looked up another word, which is basically what my sponsor and I agree on is my gift. And that is enthusiasm. God gave me enthusiasm. And I looked that word up one night in a brief moment of open-mindedness. And it comes from the word, this is a Greek word, called ethios. And what that word means is inspired by God. And my definition of an alcoholic, me today, is the breath of life inspired by God. Not a derelict of society destined to become one that nobody knows what to do with, like we saw in that movie earlier today. That wasn't that great, that flick today? Awesome. Absolutely awesome. I was the first guy, by the way, when AA came on the movie to go, yay! And started that applause. We've been saved, folks. And my definition has changed. Now really, you've been a fabulous bunch of people. I feel at home here. I did when I walked in the place. It's been a great privilege to be here. I really have enjoyed it. You know what the most useless thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is? A speaker who's already spoken.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.